I farcast to Renaissance Vector, and then to Parsimony, where I boarded a spinship for the 3-week voyage to Asquith and the crowded kingdom of Sad King Billy. Notes for a sketch of Sad King Billy. His Royal Highness, King William the 23rd, Sovereign Lord of the Kingdom of Windsor in Exile, looks a bit like a wax candle of a man who has been left on a hot stove. His long hair runs in limp rivulets to slumped shoulders, while the furrows on his brow trickle downward to the tributaries of wrinkles around the basset hound eyes, and then run southward again through folds and frown lines to the maze of wattles in neck and jowls. King Billy is said to remind anthropologists of the worry dolls of the outback Kinshasa, to make Zen Gnostics recall the pitiful Buddha after the temple fire on Taizin, and to send media historians rushing to their archives to check photos of an ancient flat-film movie actor named Charles Lawton. None of these references mean anything to me. I look at King Billy and think of my long-dead tutor, Don Balthazar, after a week-long binge. Sad King Billy's reputation for gloominess is exaggerated. He often laughs. It is merely his misfortune that his peculiar form of laughter makes most people think he is sobbing. A man cannot help his physiognomy, but in His Highness's case, the entire persona tends to suggest either buffoon or victim. He dresses, if that can be the word, in something approaching a constant state of anarchy, defying the taste and color sense of his android servants, so that on some days he clashes with himself and his environment simultaneously. Nor is his appearance limited to sartorial chaos. King William moves in a permanent sphere of dishabille, his fly unsealed, his velvet cape torn and tattered, and drawing crumbs magnetically from the floor, his left sleeve ruffle twice as long as the right, which, in turn, looks as if it has been dipped in jam. You get the idea. For all this, Sad King Billy has an insightful mind and a passion for the arts and literature which has not been equaled since the true Renaissance days on old, old Earth. In some ways, King Billy is the fat child with his face eternally pressed to the candy store window. He loves and appreciates fine music but cannot produce it. A connoisseur of ballet and all things graceful, His Highness is a klutz, a moving series of pratfalls and comic bits of clumsiness. A passionate reader, unerring poetry critic, and patron of forensics, King Billy combines a stutter in his verbal expression with a shyness which will not allow him to show his verse or prose to anyone else. A lifelong bachelor, now entering his 60th year, King Billy inhabits the tumble-down palace and 2,000-square-mile kingdom as if it were another suit of rumpled royal clothes. Anecdotes abound. One of the famous oil painters whom King Billy supports finds His Majesty walking head down, hands clasped behind him, one foot on the garden path and one in the mud, obviously lost in thought. The artist hails his patron. Sad King Billy looks up, blinks, looks around as if awakening from a long nap. "Excuse me," His Highness says to the bemused painter, "but could you please tell me, was I headed toward the palace or away from the palace?"
"Toward the palace, Your Majesty," replies the artist.
"Oh, good," sighs the king, "then I've had lunch."
General Horace Glennonhite had begun his rebellion, and the outback world of Asquith lay directly in his path of conquest. Asquith was not worried. The hegemony had offered a force space fleet as a shield, but the royal ruler of the kingdom of Monaco in exile seemed more melted than ever when he called me in. "Martin," said His Majesty, "you've heard about the battle for Fomalhaut?"
"Yeah," I said. "It doesn't sound like anything to worry about. Fomalhaut was just the kind of place Glennonhite's been hitting. Small, no more than a few thousand colonists, rich in minerals, and with a time debt of at least, what is it, 20 standard months from the web?"
23, said Sad King Billy. "So you don't think that we are in jeopardy?"
"Uh-huh," I said. "With only a 3-week real transit time and a time debt of less than a year, the hegemony can always get forces here from the web faster than the general can spin up from Fomalhaut."
"Perhaps," mused King Billy, beginning to lean on a globe and then jumping upright as it started to turn under his weight. "But nonetheless, I've decided to start our own modest hegira."
I blinked, surprised. Billy had been talking about relocating the kingdom in exile for almost 2 years, but I had never thought he would go through with it.
The ships are ready on Parvati," he said. "Asquith has agreed to provide the transport we need to the web."
"But the palace," I said, "the library, the farms, and the grounds."
"Donated, of course," said King Billy. "But the contents of the library will travel with us."
I sat on the arm of the horsehair divan and rubbed my cheek. In the 10 years I had been in the kingdom, I had progressed from Billy's subject of patronage to tutor, to confidant, to friend. But never did I pretend to understand this disheveled enigma. Upon my arrival, he had granted me an immediate audience.
"Do you wish to join the other talented people in our little colony?" he had asked.
"Yes, Your Majesty."
"And will you write more books like the Dying Earth?"
"Not if I can help it, Your Majesty."
"I read it, you know," the little man had said. "It was very interesting."
"You're most kind, sir."
"B-b-b-bullshit, M. Silenus. It was interesting because someone had obviously bowdlerized it and left in all the bad parts."
I had grinned, surprised by the sudden revelation that I was going to like Sad King Billy.
"But the Kantos," he sighed, "that was a book. Probably the finest volume of poetry published in the web in the last 2 centuries. How you managed to get that by the mediocrity police, I will never know. I ordered 20,000 copies for the kingdom."
I bowed my head slightly, at a loss for words for the first time since my post-stroke days 2 decades before.
"Will you write more poetry like the Kantos?"
"I came here to try, Your Majesty."
"Then welcome," said Sad King Billy. "You will stay in the west wing of the castle, near my offices, and my door will always be open to you."
Now I glanced at the closed door and at the little sovereign, who, even when smiling, looked as if he were on the verge of tears.
"Hyperion?" I asked.
He had mentioned the colony world gone primitive many times.
"Precisely. The android seed ships have been there for some years, Martin, preparing the way, as it were."
I raised an eyebrow. King Billy's wealth came not from the assets of the kingdom, but from major investments in the web economy. Even so, if he had been carrying on a surreptitious recolonization effort for years, the cost must have been staggering.
Do you remember why the original colonists named the world Hyperion, Martin?"
"Sure. Before the Hegira, they were a tiny freehold on one of the moons of Saturn. They couldn't last without terrestrial resupply, so they emigrated to the outback,
and named the survey world after their moon. King Billy smiled sadly. And do you know why the name is propitious for our endeavor? It took me about 10 seconds to make the connection. Keats, I said. Several years earlier, near the end of a long discussion about the essence of poetry, King Billy had asked me who was the purest poet who had ever lived. The purest, I had said. Don't you mean the greatest? No, no, said Billy. That's absurd to argue over who is the greatest. I'm curious about your opinion of the purest, the closest to the essence you describe. I had thought about it a few days and then brought my answer to King Billy as we watched the setting suns from the top of the bluff near the palace. Red and blue shadows stretched across the amber lawn toward us. Keats, I said. John Keats, whispered Sad King Billy. Ah. And then a moment later, why? So I had told him what I knew about the 19th-century old earth poet, about his upbringing, training, and early death, but mostly about a life dedicated almost totally to the mysteries and beauties of poetic creation. Billy had seemed interested then. He seemed obsessed now as he waved his hand and brought into existence a hollow model which all but filled the room. I moved backward, stepping through hills and buildings and grazing animals to get a better view. "Behold, Hyperion!" whispered my patron. As was usually the case when he was totally absorbed, King Billy forgot to stutter. The hollow shifted through a series of views: river cities, port cities, mountain areas, a city on a hill filled with monuments to match the strange buildings in the nearby valley. "The Time Tombs?" I said. "Precisely. The greatest mystery in the known universe." I frowned at the hyperbole. "They're fucking empty," I said. "They've been empty since they were discovered. They are the source of a strange anti-entropic force field which lingers still," said King Billy. "One of the few phenomena outside singularities which dares to tamper with time itself." "It's no big deal," I said. "It must have been like painting rust preventative on metal. They were made to last, but they're empty. And since when do we go bug-fuck about technology?" "Not technology," sighed King Billy, his face melting into deeper grooves. "Mystery. The strangeness of place, so necessary to some creative spirits. A perfect mixture of the classical utopia and the pagan mystery." I shrugged, not impressed. Sad King Billy waved the hollow away. "Has your poetry improved?" I crossed my arms and glared at the regal dwarf slob. "No." "Has your muse returned?" I said nothing. If looks could have killed, we would all be crying, "The king is dead, long live the king," before nightfall. "Very well," he said, showing that he could look insufferably smug as well as sad. "Pack your bags, my boy. We're going to Hyperion."